You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 218. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. This is Adam White. I'm recording for you in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, we have a usual person, and for me at least, a new person. So first of all, Mr. John Gentile, you're boring. Sorry, I know you.
John is anything but boring.
So Mr. John Gentile in Philadelphia. Actually, John, in your honor, right now. And a little bit to my chagrin, I guess, I'm drinking a can of Yingling.
Oh yeah, that's like the Philadelphia beer. Yeah. I mean, do you like that? Do you like it? Is it good?
No, but really? I have it.
People rave about it in Philadelphia. Like that is like the beer people love. But it's not good, really.
I don't know. My brother showed up here and he said that he watched someone's cat for a week. And then the guy was like, "Oh, I'll buy you a case of beer. What do you want? Do you care?" And my brother kind of stupidly said, no, whatever. And now he's got this 2-4 Yingling. So it's not something I normally drink.
Yingling is one of America's oldest. It's America's oldest breweries. How do you like that?
It's one of those, like, it's way better than no beer.
Is it better than Coors Light?
Oh, well, yeah. So that's cool. So anyways, also joining us on tonight's show, Mr. Tom Crandall out of, I just read it a second, Coopersville, Michigan.
Yeah, Grand Rapids area.
Yeah, there we go. So, hi.
How you doing, Adam?
Good. We've never been on a show together.
No, not yet.
You've been on one before, though.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so there you go.
Okay, me and Mark, the resident old-timers.
I'm used to being the old one. This is weird. Okay.
Well, I felt old when I was your age, too, but give it another decade or so.
Okay. So, anyways, we got a whole bunch of stuff that we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We're going to talk about the new Lagwagon track, Laura Jane Grace's AOL series, a new Frank Turner Rarities compilation, some weird shit that Jesse Michaels from Operation Ivy put together. We're going to talk about Greg Ginn being Greg Ginn, and we're also going to have the follow-up to this really bizarre segment that has become a part of the show that John explained to the people what this is.
Okay, so if you listen to the podcast, I guess about 3 podcasts ago, I talked about how I found this record in Jupiter Records out in Wilmington, Delaware. It's a used record by this band called The Flames. It was $5. I'm like, I checked out the titles. The titles were like Living in Bondage, Stabbed to Death, Menage a Trois, Contaminated, some really, really wild, some really wild titles. So I bought this record. I took this record home. I listened to it, and I'm like, oh man, this is a phenomenal new wave proto punk, you know, in that genre, general genre. Like, it's a great, great record. I couldn't believe I never heard of it. So I googled The Flames, couldn't find anything about them. I googled the record label, Hit Records, couldn't find anything about that. I googled the singer's name, Michael Richards. He's not Kramer, he's somebody else. Couldn't find anything about him. However, on the back of the record, written in magic marker, is a telephone number. This telephone number is 30 years old, 34 years old, because this record came out in 1980. Live on the podcast about 3 weeks ago, we called it. If you listeners were listening, you should probably listen to that podcast, because it was a mute. We called up, and we got what it sounded like, a marriage counselor. So we were pretty sure we hit a dead end. So I left my email, and we thought that was that. Well, about 2 or 3 weeks later, I get an email from somebody, and he says, "I heard you were looking for me." And I'm like, "Well, who is this?" And it turned out that it was Michael Richards, the main singer of this band, The Flames. And so I said, "Michael, this record is so great. Please let me interview you about this record and explain to me why I've never heard of this record. How come there's no record of this band ever existing?" So I guess about a week ago, I called him up. I spoke to him. And let me tell you, I'm just going to put it this way. You won't believe this story when you hear it about this record and about how we came to find Michael Richards. It's crazy. So I'm just going to leave it at that. This record is – it's a great record. The story behind this record is super interesting. The story about how we came to be aware of this record is – I mean, it's a one-in-a-million shot. You won't even believe this. So stick around till after the normal podcast. We're going to run my full interview with Michael Richards, lead singer of The Flames. It's great, let me tell you.
Cool. I haven't heard this, so I'm incredibly looking forward to hearing it. So, all right, so let's jump into stuff here. So story number one for this week, and this is one of these stories where we get to talk about a whole bunch of bands that we never get to talk about. So the nominees have been announced for the 2015 class of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, in a list that's going to make a lot of people feel really old, especially me, but, man, Tom, probably you.
Yeah, this stuff started coming out when I was in high school.
So the nominees include Green Day, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, NWA, The Smiths, Lou Reed, Sting, and Kraftwerk, among others. We have the full list here. I don't know why we're not just going through the full list here. Who else we have? The Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Chic. Who else? The Marvelettes.
Nine Inch Nails,
The Spinners.
Oh, Spinners. The Spinners. I love The Spinners.
War, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Bill Withers. So there's a huge list here. So these are nominees. Not all these people get in or anything like that. So what's going to happen is that public voting is encouraged alongside the main industry ballots that go out. Nominees need to have released their first single album before 1989 to qualify for the list, which is how Green Day actually squeaks in on this thing, because 1,000 Hours came out in 1989 on Lookout. NWA Straight Outta Compton came out in 89 on Lookout, 88 for Straight Outta Compton. Nine Inch Nails, Pretty Hate Machine, was 1989. And the Smiths, they released all their albums before 1987. Lou Reed was four albums into a solo career after a decade with the Velvet Underground. So this is how all these people ended up on the list. I know a lot of people are probably thinking, like, Green Day. That's kind of weird. But anyways, you can find this full interactive ballot thing on Punk News if you want to go click which people you think deserve to be on here. But any thoughts about this, guys? John, I imagine that you are like the world's biggest Paul Butterfield Blues Band fan, just because that seems like the kind of shit that you would be.
Let me tell you, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band is not getting – they're like one of these bands that are like – well, not like – kind of like Cream followers, or I guess a better example would be the Jeff Beck group. Is they're like – guys that are really into English blues are into that kind of stuff, but these guys are not getting in. Even though these guys are American, they're not getting in. However, I guess there's a lot of heavy hitters this year, and I think there's going to be a lot of upsets because, I mean, Lou Reed, he died this past year. He's definitely getting in. Not to mention he's got a lot of fantastic albums. NWA, will NWA get in? Run DMC got in. I think if NWA doesn't get in, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will be accused of snubbing hip-hop artists, which I don't even know if that applies to the Rock and Roll Hall Museum. I guess it does, so they're getting in. But on the other hand, you also have Chic, and as everyone knows, Nils Rodgers was in Chic, and you know Nils Rodgers is like super-duper popular right now because of his work with Daft Punk, because of his work with that sleazy – who's that sleazy guy? The son of the guy that was on Family Ties or whatever?
Oh, Robin Thicke.
Robin Thicke, yeah. He put out a song with them. What surprised me the most is with a lot of the readers hated on Joan Jett. I thought Joan Jett was universally loved, like as much as the Ramones. I thought everybody loved Joan Jett, you know?
I didn't read the comments because I'm not insane. Did people not like Joan Jett?
People were hating on Joan Jett. I don't even know why. I think Joan Jett's great. Like, people were hating on her. I think Smiths might get passed over. Spinners, they usually put in one Motown group. Well, Spinners started out as a Motown group. Spinners will probably get in. Sting is probably not going to get in because I'm just droning on and on here. But, I mean, the Police are a great band, but Sting's solo career is so weak. I mean, it's
– I agree, John. Easy listening, man.
Yeah. So anyways, as for my hopes, I hope NWA gets in. I hope the Smiths, Lou Reed, Kraftwerk should get in, and Joan Jett. Green Day, you know, they might get passed over even though they're a huge band because they're younger. But on the other hand, they might put them in because Green Day is probably the biggest name here. I mean, really, yeah, Green Day probably is the biggest name here, so they might put them in just to have them at the ceremony to get people interested in the thing, you know?
That's a horrible reason to be included, is so they can use you to market the ceremony, though.
They do that, though.
I know. So, anyways, if you've actually gone and voted on this thing, which I just did while you were talking, it tells you the current tally, at least from the public voting. So, as far as the public is concerned, and they're not the ones that actually decide this, Stevie Ray Vaughan has 25% of the vote. Nine Inch Nails have 24. Kraftwerk are at 11, and everyone else is under 10%.
Really?
And then from there, it goes from Kraftwerk down, Green Day, Joan Jett, Bill Withers, Lou Reed, The Smiths, Sting, Paul Butterfield, NWA, War, The Spinners, The Marvelettes, and Chic at 1.24%.
I'm shocked by that. Shocked.
Well, again, that's the public. And
actually, let me join on and on just a little bit more.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. People like that.
I don't think people tune in. I hope people recognize how important Chic is. You could say that Chic is the single most important band to hip-hop, because what's the very first hip-hop song or the song that's credited as the first hip-hop 12-inch single? Rapper's Delight. Where is the beat from Rapper's Delight from? Chic's Good Times.
You know far too much about things.
Yeah, I learned something.
Well, Chic is cool, man. I love Chic. I've got like 8 of their albums. You can get them at the dollar bin, like easy, you know. You know, Chic is a great group. I love Chic.
I just heard Freak Out. I kind of was checking it out, and all I could think is, oh, it's one of those wedding reception songs. The only time you ever hear that song is when you go to a wedding reception, you know.
Chic does have a lot of wedding reception songs. Unlike the Smiths, who have, like, no wedding reception songs.
No, that's not really their bag, you know?
Yeah, it's more of a Suicide-style music. I was, to prepare for this, I was reading Johnny Rotten's open letter to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that he wrote a couple of years ago. Looks like a child wrote it, like in crayon. And no self-respecting punk should really give a crap about this, you know? I think it's mostly, I just had this vision of these kind of old Mr. Burns-looking men sitting in, like, a dark basement with candles, wearing robes, choosing who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Like, let's take Green Day or Nine Inch Nails to try to drive the youth factor. Meanwhile, you know, fans of those bands are 35 and 40 years old. I don't put a whole lot of stock in it.
Prepared for this podcast?
Hey man, I'm new. I don't want to drop the ball.
Yeah, geez. Okay, well that's the sign.
I'm an overachiever. Sorry. Well, when you look at a bunch of names and some of them make you draw a blank, and maybe I better take a little.
No, we just get to them when we talk about them, and then we go, I've never heard this band, and then the readers get mad or the listeners get mad at us because we don't actually have meaningful conversations about things.
Well, John, you know, John informed us about, you know, Chic and its hip-hop origins, so at least it's been educational.
Mm.
But
I guess... Oh, go ahead. No, I don't know. I was going to segue into the next thing. I don't know. For some reason, I think if Green Day gets into this, I'm going to be really mad, even though I know it shouldn't care and it doesn't matter. For some reason, that would make me mad.
Well, you know...
But if Green Day was to get in for this, like, I don't know, like 15 years from now, I probably wouldn't care and I'd support it, but...
Green Day and Nine Inch Nails are both the type of bands where they kind of took an underground style of music and polished it up for mass consumption. You notice the Buzzcocks aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Dickies aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Front 242 and Ministry aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, it's the same old Elvis story of him taking a music that's not socially acceptable and polishing it up for mass consumption. And that's what Green Day and Nine Inch Nails are, essentially.
Tom, you're not coming out against Elvis, are you?
No, not at all. But, you know, the Beastie Boys, even to a certain extent, you know, there was this growing hip-hop culture, but it took three white guys to make it acceptable to middle America. You know, the Beastie Boys were the first one to sell a million hip-hop records to people in Ohio. You know what I'm saying? And so they're sort of like pillars of the genre where they can kind of start getting into some edgy stuff without getting anything that's really edgy as far as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or people in Ohio.
We're just anti-Ohio, really.
Yeah, we're not big into Ohio. They do neighbor us here.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's something about, and I know this is an emotional reaction to something like this, but I look at Green Day and I say, like, you guys had absolutely legendary stuff that you did, but right now you're fucking up. So because right now, you know, you're doing things that I don't particularly approve of, I don't want to celebrate all the stuff that you did back then, because that feels like it gives some sort of tacit approval to like the bad records you're releasing right now. And I don't want to do that. So, yeah.
Along those lines, Lou Reed deserves obviously getting the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Assuming you acknowledge that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is something worth debating, Lou Reed and the Smiths should get in before Green Day, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, well, I mean,
Lou
Reed's
a shoe-in. It's 40 years since his solo debut, and they just nominated him this year after his death. He's a shoe-in. There's no way he's not getting in.
Yeah, true. But, I mean, as well, he should. I mean, Lou Reed is a legend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's more influential than, you know, he didn't move a lot of units. The fact of the matter is, you know, Green Day probably sold more copies of Dookie than Lou Reed did as a solo artist.
You're probably, I mean, honestly, Green Day probably sold more copies of Dookie in South America than Lou Reed did in his entire career of anything. I'm not even kidding. You know what I mean?
Could be. Yeah.
I'll be interested to see if Kraftwerk gets in, because Kraftwerk is really the only, well, I guess Nine Inch Nails maybe, the only avant-garde group on the ballot this year. So I'll be interested to see if they get in.
You figure if you want to look at this from kind of like a family tree perspective, you figure Kraftwerk would have to get in there before Nine Inch Nails. I mean, I know the Rock Hall has all sorts of reasons why that doesn't happen, but you know, as far as like the lineage of music goes, you'd kind of want Kraftwerk to be in there first.
Well, I want Chrome to be in there if Nine Inch Nails is going to get in there.
If you look at the list of who's in and who's not, it's baffling. I can't find any rhyme or reason to it at all. So
well, I mean, I guess the issue is they only accept so many people per year, and I mean, look how many bands there are, and you know, with every decade, there's more and more bands. Every year, there's more and more bands. So they're running out of deficit. That is, so as the years progress, they have more and more of a backlog, but they can only let in so many bands. You know, so
I suppose.
All right. So, anyways, Hall of Fame. There we go. We're going to hop over to our next story here. We're going to jump over our original boring story that we decided that we were going to talk about. And instead, we're going to talk about Greg Ginn. Ginn. I keep saying Ginn. I'm on a Ginn thing right now. Alcohol.
Are you
like, not at the moment, but I've started to like explore the world of gins. It's really taking up a lot of my mind share and pushing Greg Ginn out of it. So anyways, Greg Ginn, who is not an alcohol, some stuff happened. John, I'm going to throw this over to you because this is totally a you
thing. Thanks, Adam. Thanks. All right. So anyway, Greg Ginn, he's got some problems on his hands. His problems are the following. As a lot of the listeners might know, Greg Ginn lives out in Texas. Why does Greg Ginn live out in Texas? Because that's where his kids live. What has recently happened, as of yesterday, Greg Ginn's ex-wife, Miranda, filed a motion to modify the parent-child relationship. She says that Greg Ginn has been abusing the pair's two daughters. They live separately. Basically, she says that it's an accusation. She says Greg Ginn makes them stay up real late. He says that he feeds them bad food, like unpalatable food, that he basically is mean to them and basically is verbally abusive to them. She did not accuse him of being directly physically abusive towards them. Regardless, in her affidavit filed in a Texas court, she's asking for the court to essentially give her sole custody of the kids, and it's not clear if she wants to allow Greg Ginn to see them or not. A lot of people say, oh my God, how could Greg Ginn do all these horrible things? How, you know, Greg Ginn, he's horrible. Look at all these. I really want to stress that an affidavit is not a finding of fact. An affidavit is something sworn under penalty of perjury, which basically means that Greg Ginn's wife is accusing Greg Ginn of doing these things. It has not been proven. Whether or not it does get proven or not, we'll have to see if they have a hearing on this or not. The reason I bring this up is because I feel in punk rock right now, we live in a very accusation-based society, where as soon as somebody is accused of something, they're guilty, which that's really not what our system is built on. It's the exact opposite. It's you're innocent until you're proven guilty. And that's not saying I believe Ginn is innocent. I don't believe Ginn. I don't believe if he's guilty or if he's innocent. I say there's still a lot more that we need to know before we can excommunicate somebody, if you will. I would point out that in the affidavit where she accuses him of doing all these horrible things, there's no actual documentation of physical injury, which makes her easier to accuse him of doing bad things if all the accusations don't leave any actual physical evidence. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not saying that she's lying. I'm saying I don't know, and I'm not ready to cast Greg Ginn out entirely until more evidence comes to light. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, divorces tend to bring out a lot of things in people. So I'm not saying it's not true either, but certainly I've heard many lies and I'm skeptical of it to begin with. But either that or maybe they're just he's trying to get the band back in the public eye. You know, look what's happened to the NFL. Any publicity is good publicity for Black Flag, right?
Although, if I may be my own devil's advocate, Greg Ginn is a weirdo. I don't think he would physically abuse somebody. But, I mean, he's been incredibly mentally abusive towards many band members, as we've seen towards Ron Reyes and Keith Morris and all the other guys. So he does have a history of being mentally abusive towards other people. So whether or not he was abusive towards his two daughters, it's like he has not set himself up for a good precedent.
There is a crowdfunding website related to this whole story.
There is?
Where, yeah, I mean, it was created about 10 days ago. There's only been $10 in donations to it so far, so it's not promoted very well. But if you go to GoFundMe.com/GregGinnDaughters, it's this Save My Friend's Daughters crowdfunding campaign where they're trying to raise 10 grand to pay Greg's ex-wife's attorney fees.
This might be kind of that's kind of a weird thing to do, you know what I mean?
Well, clearly not a lot of people are giving money this, which I don't think is necessarily taking sides. It's just it seems like a weird thing to be. I don't know. If I was in this situation, my first thought wouldn't be, let's hop on Kickstarter, but I don't know.
And I got to say, if you look at this, only one donation in 5 days. That's
Ron Reyes.
Zing. The first image is a big stop sign that says, stop child abuse and neglect. Greg Ginn's crazy. I have no trouble saying that. I wonder if the other people involved in this whole thing are kind of crazy as well, you know.
So. Did you ever meet the man, John? Or did you ever interview him?
I've never interviewed him. I've asked three times. One time I went around in a couple of circles and then basically got blown off. The other two times I got no response. But at Black Flag 2013, editor Joe Pallone and I went to see Black Flag, and we were watching the opening band, which I can't remember. It wasn't Cinema. I can't remember who the opening band was.
Yeah, that was this year.
And so I turned around. I saw Greg Ginn standing right behind us. And so I whisper over to Joe Pallone. I say, Joe Pallone, Greg Ginn's right behind us. Check it out. So simultaneously, we both turn our heads and stare directly at him, like 5 feet behind us. He like gives us this weird, creeped out look, and then immediately goes to the other side of the room.
Well, I met him real briefly this summer, and I just thought he came across as the nicest guy. And, you know, that whole curmudgeon image, he doesn't seem to want to fight about it. You know what I mean? He doesn't see, like Ben Weasel, he doesn't want to rehab his image. It's almost as if he's kind of cultivating that image.
If I may jump, when I saw him in 2014, he's on stage. He's like, oh, thanks so much for coming out. It really means a lot to me. And I'm thinking, wow, Greg Ginn's a really nice guy. And then I'm thinking, no, he's not. He's said all these vicious, vicious, vicious things about Keith Morris and Ron Reyes. Like, he really was not nice to Ron Reyes. Like, he blamed Ron Reyes for the failure of Black Flag 2013. And I'm like, this is probably how he gets people to do all these things for him. Like, he has a very friendly je ne sais quoi, you know, a very warm personality. But behind it, I think there's something incredibly vicious and dark, which is why he's able to make that music. But that's a different issue.
Well, you know, in 2013, he was playing at 2,000-seat theaters. In 2014, he was playing 500-seat clubs. Maybe he decided he better get nice, took a Dale Carnegie course or something. I don't know. I found him to be very, very nice, but, you know, I talked to him for 2 minutes. So.
I think he can appear very nice. I think Greg Ginn is a maniac and a genius, and that's why he's been able to get people to do these things for him throughout the history of his career, and that's why he's one of the greatest guitar players of all time, and that's why everybody hates him, you know.
Random fact, at one point in my life, I used to help assistant coach Dale Carnegie courses. I don't really know how that helps anything in this conversation.
I like to throw random old-timey stuff in there to throw the youngsters off there listening to this right now.
Yeah. You know? Anyone remember the self-help book from the 30s? Exactly. We're going to talk about it in the Punk News podcast.
Exactly.
So I'll be very interested to see what becomes of this. Honestly, I'm going to bet that nothing becomes of this, and it just kind of fades away, to tell you the truth. But we'll see.
I'm glad to get your legal opinion on that, because not that you were giving your legal opinion, I understand the disclaimer there, but your opinion as a person with knowledge of how
system works. Nothing that I say should be constituted as legal advice. I'm just giving my general opinion of the legal aspects of this case, but I'm not giving anyone any advice. But let's talk about something.
Well, hold on. If you send a $20 bill to Adam White, care of the Punk News Podcast, then John's advice does constitute actual legal advice.
Adam, don't get me disbarred here. I'm in front of the judge. Is it true that you had someone accept a $20 bill on your behalf to give out advice over a podcast? I'll be like, oh, you're right.
Like, I don't even know what that is. And okay, so next here, speaking of old people, Lagwagon have released another new song from their forthcoming effort, Hang, which is due out on October 28th via Fat Records. The song is called Burden of Proof / Rain, and you can hear it over at Revolver. Now, they had a previously released song that you can check out on Punk News called The Cog in the Machine as well. So both those songs are appearing on Hang, which comes out October 28th. The band's going to be headed out on tour in November with Swingin' Utters and The Legend, or sorry, This Legend. That. So anyways, Lagwagon, new song. Not a band that we seem to talk about a lot on this show, or even Punk News, I think, that much, even though they're really a huge band as far as the kind of epiphat stuff that we grew up in goes. Any thoughts on this?
I didn't think it was too bad. Like, not love. That's how I've always felt about Lagwagon. You know, they're solid.
Lagwagon is editor Chris Moran's like very favorite band, or one of his very favorite bands. You know, they're kind of one of the classic 90s epiphat bands. One of the commenters said this sounded like new wave of British heavy metal. And I got to say, like, the riffs and the guitars really did sound like new wave of British heavy metal. Like,
the riff at the beginning was very metal.
Yeah, it was, like, very Judas Priest circa 1982, you know? I'm not necessarily a huge Lagwagon fan, but I'm not a hater. It just, that did catch me off guard. And if they're doing, I guess, daring stuff, you know, that's cool. That's interesting.
See, I got to be the guy here that's going to be not diplomatic about this. There's something about... I don't know. I mean, it's fine. I mean, I listened to it and it's fine. Lagwagon was never one of those bands that I was into at the time, and I always felt that, like, you know, I was into NoFX, and the NoFX version of that sound in my head is the version of that sound that exists. So Lagwagon to me sounds like, yeah, all right, they kind of doing a NoFX thing, but they're taking themselves too seriously. And I know that's not fair, and the band has, you know, a huge fan base and a big depth of their catalog, and they've been through a lot, and the stuff that Joey Cape sings about is really meaningful and blah, blah, blah. But anyways, I just can't do it. So, I don't know. I'm glad that people like this, but Lagwagon is not a band that I have figured out how to latch on to. Although, I want to segue into something that's totally randomly not related to this, but popped into my head as I was reading the Lagwagon story, and therefore I have a mental connection about it here. So we posted a link on the little quick links section on the top of Punk News today that I think everyone should go check out. And it's from a Toronto-based music publication called aux.tv. And it's a guide to Toronto's feedback-drenched noise punk scene. And it's just this it's a little review of a like 20-minute documentary that came out about that scene. And then they walk through a bunch of these bands that play this kind of music, bands like HSY and Soup Cans and Adonis is really the big one. And going through all these bands out of Toronto that are these super cool, really distortion-y, grungy, messy sounding punk bands. And I was reading our Lagwagon article, and I thought, like, yeah, okay, it's another Lagwagon article. And then I went and I read this thing, and I just felt completely inferior as far as being a punk music publication, let me tell you. I'm just like, man, there's all these really cool bands that are out there doing really mean-sounding, neat stuff, and we haven't talked about any of these bands. But we're still talking about Lagwagon.
Well, you know, you're right. Honestly, we need to talk about more of the meaner and the nastier and the, you know, the smashinger punk rock bands. You're right, Adam. When you're right, you're right.
I mean, it's not so much that, like, Lagwagon does not deserve to be talked about or anything like that, but I'm just, like, looking at this, like, I'm looking at this huge list of bands. I'm walking down this article, playing each of their, like, Bandcamp links to myself. Each one in their own way is really cool. And I'm like, I don't recognize, like, 9/10 of these bands, and they're fucking quasi-local to me. And, like, God, we're bad at this. So that's my publicly griping about this. So, yeah, once I rule the world, we'll probably talk more about these bands.
You figure out how to make those bands drive traffic. I suspect it'll change things quite a bit. Lagwagon, you know, get 50 comments about, and some other cool band might get none. So
I know, and
just don't know. And
back when I was in college, and I was able to, like, you know, basically, like, spend all my time writing punk news stories, I used to write a lot of stories about all these bands that no one had ever heard of that did all this kind of, like, weird stuff. And I would just go on these, like, tangents that would produce, like, a bunch of stories over time, and no one would comment on any of them, but I'd feel really good about themselves. I'd feel really good. Like, at one point, like, I went on this, like, this huge, like, Bomp Records thing, where I was just pulling, like, as many weird things out of, like, the Bomp catalog and writing stories about them. This was back when, like, the Black Lips were on Bomp, but the Black Lips hadn't really, like, gotten involved. I don't even know if Vice was a record label at the point. They hadn't, like, you know, kind of blown up in the way that they had. So we're just, like, talking about all these, like, weird punk bands. And, man, I miss doing that. I'm going to try to do that more. So this is just, like, my public declaration of this. I was going to use the Lagwagon story to get into the stories. We're going to talk about more weird shit on punk news now.
I'm down. The problem is, whenever I put up weird bands, I get, you know, I'm not going to boohoo myself. I agree, Adam. More weird stuff on the Punk News podcast. Let's do it. Yeah.
Oh, on the Punk News website too. We're just gonna go more weird.
Baby. Let's get freaky.
And then every Lagwagon article will be like an island in the sea of weirdness that everyone will cling to be like, I don't know what Adam and John are doing to the website.
Let's just make it chaos.
What, the one Lagwagon story generates more comments than the entire month leading up to it.
The month of garbage that we put together and then the Lagwagon story.
The only comments on the other bands are from their cousins and mothers.
Yeah. So anyways, that was I don't know. I don't know why I brought that up. It wasn't planned. Anyways. What are we doing? A podcast? What are we talking about? What's next?
Let's talk about Bomp real quickly. Bomp has put out a lot of good records, but they put out a lot of junk, too.
Bomp has put out so much junk, but Bomp is one of those labels that has been around forever, and that's kind of fascinating to me.
They put out Dead Boys records.
Yeah, but they put out a lot of, like, shit Dead Boys records, yeah, like after the Dead Boys were a
straight
thing.
Straight from cassette, live, yeah.
Yeah, right, like a lot of that kind of stuff. Bomp was a weird label, but, like, I'm just looking at their website right now, and I haven't been there in a long time, and it looks totally different right now. They did a lot of, like, really, like, cool kind of, like, Raj Rocky stuff that over the years, and some of it was really neat, and some of it was bleh. And I mean, the big thing for me was that they're the label that backed Alive Records, like Alive Natural Sound, and that was, like, a lot of really straight, cool garage stuff that was out at the time. So, like, that was, like, almost like a sub-label of theirs, I guess, at the time. So, like, there was a lot of stuff that was out. I'm just trying to think, looking at their bands, like Black Diamond Heavies. Like, Black Diamond Heavies were a really cool band. So I think they were like a bass and drums driven two piece. I think, I don't really remember too much. Like early Black Keys stuff came out on Alive. There was neat stuff that came out there. But anyways, though, Bomp was a fascinating place to go and explore, because you'd get in there and you'd have these, like, old, like, bizarre garage bands just full of, like caveman stomp drumming. And you figure that, like, somewhere in the world there is a scene that is really into this, but I could not imagine who it is and where they're from. But they managed to sustain this thing, so I don't know. I remember I went through a lot of my back when I was in college. I had, like, I made a point of, like, wearing a Bomp shirt all over the place, because that was my rebellion against things that people actually cared about.
For the one in a thousand people who comes up to you and starts a conversation about your bomb shirt.
I'd meet some old man in a record store and he'd be like, hey, bomb. Like, yes, worth the shipping.
It's Bump Records, if you want 17 demo takes of I Got It Right by the Stooges, you know?
Yeah. I know, like, they put out so much weird shit. But you gotta... I'd love to know, like, the economy of how something like Bump works, because Bump puts out so much, or they have over the years. So someone's got to be buying it. Like, it costs money to print all this stuff.
Here's how it works. Like, a couple they don't pay the artists.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always wonder how legit Bump Records is, because they've got all these, like, it's like, you know, ninth generation Stooges live in a basement somewhere. They obviously didn't get that cleared by the Stooges, so who did they get that cleared by, you know? So,
oh, yeah, they put out so much stuff like that. And I remember, like, at one point, I
thought this became the Hate on Bump podcast. Bump!
They got it cleared by the guy who had the boombox that was recording it. I gave
Bump more podcast press than they've ever got right now. So, yeah. No, I remember, like, at one point, like, along with whatever I ordered, you could chip in, like, I don't know, like, $5 on your order, and they'd give you, like, just, like, a handful of random Bump crap. And I had all these CDs that were just these weird ass bands that I did not like at all, or just like, I couldn't even get rid of them. It's just like, I'm like, oh, no one wants this. Now they've given it to me. But anyways, yeah. So
now might be a good time to announce our new corporate sponsorship of Bump Records, our new partnership.
Yeah, they have a lot of like Stiv Bader's stuff that they put out that I'm sure Stiv Bader's estate had nothing to do with. And
you know, that's the thing with like Dead Boys and New York Dolls. There is so much bootleg or semi-legit Johnny Thunders, New York Dolls, or Stiv Bader's Dead Boys stuff. Like, does somebody own like 30 like Dead Boys like bootlegs or semi-legit things? And, like, listens to them. I don't think anybody actually listens to this stuff, you know? Because it's always disappointing when you get, like, this crap. You're like, oh, man, it's, like, an unreleased, you know, Dead Boys concert. And you get it. And
there's a reason.
Yeah, and it's like, and, like, Stiv Bader's is, like, passed out. So all you hear is, like, a drum and, like, a bass somewhere in, like, the left speaker. And, like, that's the whole album, you know? Yeah, I hope the youth listening to this podcast are appreciating us talking about the Dead Boys bootlegs from 1992, you know?
Oh, fuck the kids. All right, what's next? I don't know. I lost the list of stories we were talking about. Should we play a song? Yeah, it feels like we should play a song.
We should play something from Bump, but yeah, let's play a song.
Sonic Reducer, 1979, live.
I don't think we have the rights to that.
Yeah, we should do, and then it's just static, you know?
I don't think, actually, check this.
Oh, one of the shit versions of Sonic Reducer.
What's Bump going to do, sue you? They don't have rights to it either.
I'm going to tell you this, though, kids. Right now on the Bump's website, for $3, you can get the Deviants' Greatest Hits. This is a phenomenal CD. The Deviants were kind of a proto-punk, like, later-day hippie band with Mick Farren, who actually recorded some punk rock singles. That's a deal, I'll tell you.
Well, now who's shilling for Bump here?
I am. For the Deviants, man. They got a whole bunch of CDs I got to buy. Holy shit. For $3. Holy.
You're funding the machine. All right. So here's a song. This is not from Bump. This is from Deranged. Anyways, we're going to play a track from Neighborhood Brats. They're a really cool band out of Los Angeles. Long Beach. Sorry, California. They're a quartet, female fronted. They have been described by the LA Times as a female-fronted black flag. I love Bump's description of them here, because they say that their new record, which came out this year called Recovery, is 12 new cuts of pre-Reagan, post-Neutron Bomb hardcore punk. So, yeah, so this we're going to play a song from that. The song I'm going to play you is... Yeah, I should really write these things down. We're going to play a song called Boys for 20 Years. It's the second track off of Recovery, and you can grab the CD or LP of that from Deranged Records.
Have you
We have a podcast to do.
Don't bother me, Adam. I'm looking through the Bomp discography right now.
Still? Through that whole song?
Yes. right now, I'm between their 127th and 128th Stooges live bootleg from 1971.
Okay, well, while you're doing that, we're make some mention of something cool that showed up online this week. The first four episodes of True Trans with Laura Jane Grace are now available. The show's a documentary series, just a series of kind of like short little episodes, I guess, that feature the Against Me vocalist that were put together last April. So it's a 10-part series. It follows the Against Me frontwoman as she travels around the country, meeting with transgender men and women, discussing the various ideas and politics and kind of like personal stories related to gender and the, you know, everyone's personal stories of coming out and the hardships that came around with that. So the show takes its name from the True Trans EP. Of course, that was a precursor to the Transgender Dysphoria Blues record that came out this year. So you can find all four episodes of this thing you can get them from Punk News, but they're on, what is it? AOL. AOL's, if you go to on.aol.com, they will be there. It's in the AOL Originals video series. So you should go check those out. Now, we can't really mention True Trans without plugging the real star of True Trans, Punk News podcast contributor Tricky Ricky Frankel, who appears in the crowd scene in the show footage from the first episode, and he has not shut up about it since.
Well, so you got to give him props because he's wearing an Alternative Tentacles t-shirt. So
yeah, so Tricky if Ricky, you want to see a blurry picture of Punk News podcast contributor Ricky Frankel in an Alternative Tentacles t-shirt for like 4 seconds in a documentary that has absolutely nothing to do with him, you can see that if you go watch True Trans with Laura Jane Grace. Or you could watch it for like all the real valid reasons that you should watch that. But anyways, did you guys take a look at this? Did you watch it at all? Did you see it?
I did watch it. I watched the first few episodes. Man, I'm still looking at the Pomp discography. I gotta stop looking at this. Anyways, I did, you know, I enjoyed this, although honestly, I felt it was a little fluffy, to tell you the truth. I don't, with the amount of build up to this, I thought it was going to be like a super revealing documentary about Laura Jane Grace, about, you know, where she comes from, what she feels, what can we expect, what makes her tick. And instead, it's just kind of like, here's Laura Jane Grace doing Laura Jane Grace stuff and talking to people about their experiences. I didn't feel as though I learned a lot. I thought I learned a little bit about individual people, but I didn't come away with any major revelation, which is what I was expecting. Maybe that's too high of a burden to place on this, but they did do a lot of build-up on this.
I was looking at it from – see, I had those – I was thinking about that at first, and I thought – like, I watched the four episodes earlier today, and, you know, I enjoyed them as I was watching them. They're well put together. And then I thought that, like, you know – this is all rather celebratory. I mean, like, it makes me feel good, but you know, I guess from a, if you want to look at documentaries as a form of journalism, from a journalism perspective, it's not really telling me anything that I didn't know, or, you know, it's not breaking any ground I wasn't expecting it to. But on the other hand, I got to kind of step back and think about this. And like, this is the lead singer from Against Me that came out as trans, and, you know, that's a huge deal, and we've just kind of like accepted it as, you know, yeah, that happened a year ago, whatever. So I guess the fact about like how normalized that's become in our world is totally a statement, I guess, towards how far just like Laura's profile has gone to kind of like make this part of the conversation and make it such like a normal part of the conversation. So that's kind of cool if you think about it. But I don't know. Did you check this out, Tom?
I did not. You know, I'm a pretty big Against Me fan. I probably should try to get to it. My hours to do these kind of things, I listen, have a lot of time to listen, but I don't have a lot of time to watch. But I will try to check that out. I would probably rather listen to the play music, but I will check that out eventually. I'm curious.
Anytime John makes me watch anything for this, it's a huge burden to actually make that happen in my day. So I don't blame you.
You know, I've seen Against Me a number of times, and it's been kind of strange because I saw them right before she made the announcement you know, when it was still Tommy and he had the short hair. And then I saw her, saw them while she was growing the hair out and starting to kind of wear jewelry and stuff. And then I've seen her a couple of times since. It's just, it's been an interesting process. Like, I've seen the metamorphosis at all in a live setting. It's something, man. But she seems to be doing well. And if this show is in fact a victory lap, then cool. I'm cool with that.
So, speaking of John making me watch videos.
Yes.
John.
Oh, this video rules, man. Let me tell you.
You have to explain the symbolism to me, John. It goes right over my head.
I actually didn't do an article for this, and I feel as though I should have. We just did a quick link for this, and in the quick link, we put, let's see, it's like, watch Jesse Michaels' new avant-garde music video. Watch Jesse Michaels' new avant-garde short film. And the short film is called Horizon Bastard. It's about a minute long. And I'll just explain it to you. Like, you got to watch this. But basically, there's a girl in Jesse Michaels' apartment, and she's like, Jesse, what are you – actually, his name is Yonke. So she's like, Yonke, what are you doing in the apartment? He's like, go in the bathroom. She's like, what are you doing in the bathroom? He's like, go in the bathroom. So she, like, forces to open the door. And, like, the toilet is, like, filled with blue paint, and he's got it all over his face. And he's like, will you treat me like you're my mommy? And the girl's just, like, grossed out. And, like, then it pans over to his hairless cat, and that's the end of the film. I love this. I mean, really, there's no great meaning to this. It's just silliness. It's just for fun. Jesse Michaels even said that he was just doing this because he's a fan of David Lynch and Twin Peaks and that kind of stuff. So he was just doing... I guess random or almost random collisions of symbolism that don't necessarily have an underlying meaning. It's just a interesting, weird contrast. I don't think Jesse Michaels sees it as the thing that's going to define his career, but I think it shows several things. A, it shows that Jesse Michaels is a true artist and that he's willing to make these weird things just for the whimsy of making them. It also shows that he's got too much time on his hands.
Clearly, he should be recording records.
But what I found was interesting is this is very creepy of me, but I'm pretty sure the film is in his house, and you can, like, see his art on the walls and stuff. And I found it interesting that he hangs his own art on his walls, but also I found it interesting the art that he does have on the walls often has similar themes to his music and that kind of thing. So I just found this whole thing fascinating, and I think it's a wonderful glimpse into Jesse Michaels. Though I will add a corollary to that. The corollary is the following. Is Jesse Michaels has made some of the greatest punk rock music of all time.
All right, so...
That's not my corollary. I was taking a breath for impact. The point is this is... I do feel as though Jesse Michaels is a step above... almost all other artists. Like he's extremely creative. That being said, when he does things, I think things that are obvious or interesting to him goes over people's heads, including myself. So, you know, I actually sort of asked him about this, and I think he got annoyed that I was asking him, maybe just because it was me. But I think as though he gets annoyed that people don't quite get this kind of thing and don't get what he's attempting to do, and so that frustrates him as an artist. And that's just my guess, because Jesse Michaels is an incredibly difficult person to pin down, even more difficult than like Keith Morris or Buzz Osborne. Like, I'm never exactly sure what Jesse Michaels' motivation is.
So, speaking of pin down, could you identify the drum riff that starts this thing?
No, but let me listen right now while you guys talk.
You know what I thought it was, or at least what it brings into my head? And I just checked on YouTube and it's not it. But, well, you listen to it and then I'll tell you what I thought it was.
Let me listen right now. You guys can talk while I listen to it, or I can talk while I listen to it. So the very opening drum riff, correct?
Yeah, very opening drum riff.
Let's see here.
This is definitely vintage John Gentile, where the analysis is five times as long as the art itself.
Yes.
I don't know if there's anything wrong with that, though. I'm listening right now.
You listen.
I'm listening.
Well, John listens. I'd like to plug our new... Okay. So you said, oh. Okay.
That's from something. I know that
so
is.
Here's what I thought it was at first, and it's not, at least not according to the YouTube clip. I just tried to sync up against it. I thought it was I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea by Elvis Costello, but it is not.
Let me listen again.
Everyone who listens to our show is super interested in this section. I'd like to plug our sponsor, Bomp Records.
As I say, our new corporate partnership, yeah. Bomp Records.
Like the reverb or that sound is very unique. Listen, kids. I want you all to listen to this Jesse Michaels video. Watch the Jesse Michaels video. And if you can identify that drum riff, I will send you a Punk News prize package. You can reach us at podcast at punknews.org. And also, while you're at it, tell us what you think of the Jesse Michaels video. Is it a daring new experimental art, or is it just, you know, pretentious? I don't think it's pretentious, but I'm saying some people said it is. What's your opinion on the Jesse Michaels video? Podcast at punknews.org.
Yeah, if you want to find the video, which is probably hard because the link might not be on Punk News by the time anyone hears this, go to YouTube, search for Horizon Bastard. Or send $20 to Adam White. Okay, so there's one more story on our list here. It's not super interesting to me, so we'll see what we can do with it. So Frank Turner is going to release his third Rarities compilation. So the third comp here is called The Third 3 Years. It's due out on November 24th via Extra Mile. So it includes a whole bunch of stuff. So along with various demos and live recordings are covers of a bunch of artists. So there's covers on there. Bruce Springsteen, Queen, Tom Petty, The Weakerthans, his Tony Sly cover from the Tony Sly tributes on that thing. So you can check out all that stuff. You can check out actually a stream of the piano version of the song The Way I Tend to Be on Punk News. And this is one of the many things that has followed up the 2013 release of Tape Deck Heart. So there are 21 songs on this sucker, and you can find the whole track list on Punk News as well. There's a Wings cover.
Wings is cool, man. I love Wings, especially Band on the Run.
So, anyways, yeah.
Poncho and Lefty. The Willie Nelson. Was it Willie Nelson? Waylon Jennings? Poncho and Lefty. That's the one. That's the one I'm looking forward to.
I feel like he's had a lot of these, and there's something about the way that they've come out. I don't find that interesting. And, like, I like Frank Turner. Don't get me wrong. I do. I don't think I don't like demo collections like this. Like, they usually, just by the very nature of them, are impossibly to, like, you know, to sequence really well. And it just makes me sort of wish I had whatever weird things these originally came on, or I just listened to them on the internet. I don't know. Like,
I'm very rarely interested in when rock guy takes big, bombastic, smashing rock song and then drains it of all intensity and edge and plays it acoustically. I'm just not into that, man. Was that vicious? I feel that was vicious.
Well, I'm looking at the list here, and maybe he's not totally solo on some of these. We're just assuming. But, like, I don't know if you should do a totally solo version of, like, Live and Let Die. Like, that song sort of only exists to be, like, completely in excess.
You know, really, I mean, honestly, the only thing that I want to hear is 17th Generation Dead Boys shows out on Bomp Records.
Yes. Join us next week when we dissect the Skyclad catalog of Sex Pistols remnants. Sorry, go ahead, guys.
You know what? Bomp is the kind of label that probably has a couple of, like, Sex Pistols boots. Let's see.
Well, there was all those weird labels that you'd have, like, one or two CDs from in the 90s, and they'd have a couple of Sex Pistols songs or something that weren't on the regular LPs. One of them was Skyclad, and there was all these weird labels. And, oh, we could, you know, take one a week. The kids would be fascinated. They'd be glued to their computers.
I remember once in a while you get, like, a copy of, like, what was that British music band? Mojo, right? That would come with, like, a CD or something like that, and there'd always be, like, a random Sex Pistols song on the CD, yes. And it would be, like, you know, like the Sex Pistols, like live in some, you know, shithole chip shop.
That was, yeah, the usual one. Chelmsford Sex Pistols live. In, when I got
I have that bootleg.
Yeah, so did I. Tara, I mean, I love the Sex Pistols. So I was like, oh man, you know, a live Sex Pistols show from the original run, and you get it, and it sounds like a radio static. I mean, it's terrible.
It's a little dry.
Anyways, I think we're out of stories. Anything else that we need to bring up to people?
Just that next, you know, since we're so timely this week talking about the Sex Pistols and Dead Boys, next week we'll be talking about Elvis. Will he crack the charts? Will he change rock and roll as we know it? Is he rock and roll? And will swing music continue to exist? I mean, that's the real question. Swing's here to stay. That's what I say. But in the meantime, listen, kids. Stay listening to the podcast because we are about to have my interview with the Flames. Rather, Michael Richards of the Flames. And I'm telling you, kids, this is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. This is about an extremely, extremely, extremely obscure record that I'm sure you haven't heard, and most people haven't heard, so there's no shame in that. Listen to this interview. Let's listen to a track off the album. Let's listen to Do You Love It?
When I'm in your arms, I wonder what goes on. I wonder how you feel inside. Do you think about me? Are you off on some fantasy? Well, tell me, tell me, tell me, baby, what goes on inside?
And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and I am here with a very special guest. I'm super excited to have this man on the podcast with us. I am here with Michael J. Richards, not Kramer, but an entirely different Michael Richards. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Real good. Now, I need to explain to the Punk News listeners who you are and why it's crazy that I'm getting to speak to you. So let me give the listeners a little bit of a background. I was in the record store, the used record store, about a couple of months ago when I saw this record by this band called The Flames, and it looked pretty cool. And I flipped it over, and on the back it had song titles called, like, Living in Bondage, Stabbed to Death, You Always Survive, Punish Me, Contaminated, Nothing Seems to Work Out. I saw these wild, wild, like, lyrics and titles, so I said, well, I have to check this record out. So I bought this record, and I took it home. The record is from 1980, I believe. Let me see here.
That's right.
1980. And I played this record, and I could not believe that this record was, I want to say, perfect, edgy, new wave, maybe proto-punk or punk rock. I could not believe how great these songs were, and I guess how masterfully simple and clever they were along with the lyrics. And I said to myself, how have I never heard of this band? Because basically, as most people know, Almost every single punk rock new wave band has been well documented. Well, I tried to find something about this band online. They're called The Flames. Well, I couldn't find anything about that way because James Brown Band is The Flames. The record label is Hit Records. Well, I couldn't find anything about that because that's a common term. The lead singer who we're speaking to with right now is Michael J. Richards, and if you Google that, all you get is Seinfeld. But what was crazy is on the back of my particular copy was handwritten in marker, Michael Richards and a New York phone number. And this phone number is, I don't know, 30 years old, 30, 34 years old. So in the off chance, we gave it a call, and it was like a marriage counselor or something. So we left a message, and we thought, well, we'll never get to contact him. But lo and behold, here we are speaking with Michael Richards. So first, Michael, first of all, how did we end up getting in contact with you? Because this is crazy.
It is crazy. It's really something out of a movie almost. And I'll briefly tell you, we did the album in 1980, and in about this time in 1980, in the fall, I was in New York City, and I was shopping the album. And what I used to do is write my name and contact number on the back of the album. There's a white space below the photos there. And long story short, I was staying with my sister. That was her phone number. And 34 years later, it's still her phone number. It used to be her home number, and now it's her office number. So that's how that came about. And that's really remarkable. It's just one of those things, you know, serendipity all these years later. And when she called me, I guess sometime after she received a message from you, and at first, I just, my mind couldn't compute, like, who's calling my sister? How would anybody know that we are even connected because she's married, has a different last name? And then I thought about it, and I thought, wow, it must have something to do with the Flames, because it's the only time I ever gave my number out to anybody in New York. So that's how that came about all these years later.
Well, that's crazy. I'm so glad we got to contact you. So, Michael, tell me, was the Flames your first band, or did you have bands before the Flames?
No, actually, my story goes back quite a bit before that. My first band was probably around 1964, and then my second band, let me just mention this, I was living in Canada. I was a kid at the time. I grew up in Canada. I was born in England, and when I was 8 years old, we moved to Canada. So around 1965 was my first band called The Royal Family, and we had two singles out in Canada that charted. And actually, one of those singles is, apparently, I've never heard of it, is on a punk compilation from the 60s called Nightmares from the Underworld. And the reason I know this is because, I don't know if you know this gentleman, Doug Shepherd, he writes for Ugly Things. He contacted me a few years ago about the Royal Family, and then my subsequent band after that, Troika, which were the same people minus one as the Royal Family, and we had a deal with Atlantic Records. And actually, that Troika album has just been reissued this year by Rhino Records on the Real Gone label, and it came out in February. So that came out in 1970, Troika. So the Royal Family was 1965, 66 in that era. And then we morphed into Troika till about 1970, and then the band disbanded. The Flames was 10 years after that. So that's just a brief history of what came before that. I also did another album about the mid-70s with the bass player from Troika. And the Flames was a project that I had all these songs, and I thought, it's time. I want to put a band together, do a finished product, and then do it all independently, and then basically try to shop it. The reason you've never heard of us is because this album was never released. We never played live. Very briefly, I got the band together. Can I go on a little bit and just tell you the story? I'll try to be very brief about it. But Michael, I had all these songs.
Michael, please, go ahead. Please take your time. I knew the listeners. I'm excited to hear all about this band because this record is so great. I'm so upset that it didn't get a wider release.
Well, you know, first of all, let me thank you so much for your enthusiasm and your comments about this, because I love this album. And I hadn't really listened to it much lately, and then, you know, since you and I have been in touch, I started listening to it really closely. And my wife loves this album, and she thinks that she'd be out there. But anyway, I love the album. So backtracking, I didn't have a band, say, you know, Troika was my band that disbanded in the 70s, and then I had, you know, various other things going up in Canada during the 70s. But around probably 1979, I started writing these songs. And about probably February of 1980, I thought, you know, I've got to get something going here. You know, this is good stuff. And I'm really, you know, trying to make a move here. So I noticed, I thought, how do I put a band together? I was living in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I really didn't know anybody. I had a friend, a keyboard player from before, who's on the Flames album, and then but I didn't know where he was at the time, and so I was basically on my own. And I saw an ad in the newspaper for turned out the bass player and the drummer were looking to form a band. Ironically, they wanted to do a keyboard oriented kind of new wave thing, and I was playing guitar. I wrote all these songs on acoustic guitar at home. And I thought, you know, I'll give them a call anyway. So long story short, I went over to their place, and just on acoustic guitar, I played the song Contaminated, and they really liked it. So we decided to get together. So we started rehearsing. I said, look, here's my idea. I've got all these songs. I want to get into the studio, cut an album, do the whole thing, and then try and shop this, and I really want to go for it. So we practiced as a three-piece, and then somewhere along the line, this is early 1980, my friend Gordy, who, you know, is playing on the Flames album, somehow showed up back in town or whatever, and we connected. So I said, do you want to come over and, you know, I got this band going. So he came over. So the four of us rehearsed these songs and got them studio ready. And then I'm thinking it was probably June of 1980, we went into the studio. In Vancouver, Total Sounds West. And part of the reason I went there is because the engineer there, and I think the manager of the studio, was Carlton Lee, and he had worked on the Goat's Head Soup album by the Rolling Stones. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of guy I'd like to have engineering. So we had a good rapport. We went in, and we basically cut this album live in 2 days. When we went in, I didn't know how much we were going to get done. We had these 12 songs plus a few others rehearsed, and I thought, well, maybe we'll get one song recorded. Maybe we'll get four songs recorded, do an EP. Let's just go in there and start recording and see what we come up with. Long story short, in 2 days, we had all the band tracks down for all these songs. And then I went back in and overdubbed all the vocals. When we recorded the band tracks, I did, like, just guide vocals, but I wasn't really trying to do them, you know. I was concentrating on playing. Then I went back in, overdubbed the vocals and then a few guitar parts, and that was it. I tried to keep it very simple. I had a definite concept of what I wanted to do, and just the whole band. So we finished up probably recording in June of 1980. I went down to LA, I think probably July of 1980, to Location Recorders and mastered it. And I remember the mastering engineer really liked the album. Said, you know, if you bring your band down to L.A. and start playing around, you know, things will go well for you. And then I went back to Vancouver. It's probably August. I did, like, the artwork and the pressing. I ran 1,000 copies of the album, 1,000 singles, which had one side was Do You Love It? The other side was Contaminated. And that was August. Now, here's where things changed. Everything was set to go. Thought this was really, you know, the big move. September the 1st of 1980, my wife left me. And I was devastated, beyond devastated. I won't go into all the drama. Anyway, long story short, I sort of dragged myself down to New York. I just thought I'd have to get the heck out of Vancouver. And my sister was in New York. And this is an interesting little sidebar. She had sublet an apartment. Turned out it was Willem Dafoe's apartment, and it was across the street from CBGB. I remember that. And we were there for a few weeks, and then she got an apartment uptown. She was married, and I helped her move. And that's when she got the phone number that's on the back of the Flames album connected. It was a brand new phone number. And I went around to record companies in New York, and just, you know, took the album in. And I mean, I went to Atlantic Records because I had previous connection there. And a lot of people liked the album. I remember one fellow over Island Records, I forget his name, I think he helped Madonna a year or two later, really liked the album. Another company, I can't remember their name, they said they genuinely liked it, but no one would sign me. I don't know what it was. All I heard was, oh, there's a recession, we got no money, blah, blah, blah. And so the album never got, I just couldn't get it picked up in New York. So I went back to Vancouver, got served with divorce papers. Then the keyboard player quit. So we played a couple, one club date in Vancouver as a three-piece, guitar, bass, and drums. Then the bass player and the drummer quit. So I was all on my own. I put another band together with three other guys, the lead guitar player from Troika, my old band, and a bass player and drummer that I hired, and we did one more club date, and that was it. So this lineup, as you see on the Flames album, never played live once as that unit. And again, long story short, I just had no band. Some people liked it. A lot of people just didn't get it. I got some heavy criticism from various circles. And I don't know, then I got just all kind of tied up in this divorce thing for a couple of years. And then I moved to LA in 84 and stopped it there a bit. And again, couldn't get anything happening. And it just sort of just became part of the history of my life. And 34 years later, you called me. So that's where we are now.
Well, I'm glad at least we're getting to talk now. You know, one of the things that really stuck out is how wild some of these lyrics are. I know, like, You Always Survive kind of has lyrics about getting beat up by cops and stuff. And, you got right. Lyrics like stabbed to death. I mean, was that something that you were thinking about at that time? Was that something you were involved in? Or is that just what you thought was interesting to write about?
Well, you know, good question. I thought about that as I was listening to the album. A lot of the lyrics on this album are what I was going through or had been going through, and some of them were a little bit fictional. What's interesting is these days when I write, it's pretty much from my own experience. I don't write too much in a fictional manner. And a lot of it was from my own experience, and some of it I would just... I don't know, it's hard to describe the writing process, and it's a little different at different stages of one's life, but I would just kind of get into a zone, and basically would come down to, I think, you know, I have pretty good instincts. I just know when something sounds right, and it's when I go, yeah, that's cool. I would like to listen to that. And so I don't question it too much, whether it's absolutely factual or whatever, just as long as it sounds good and affects me somehow in a good way. So yeah, some of the stuff was from a lot of it was from my experience. And actually, in a way, it's a bit ironic. A lot of this has to do with the relationship I had with my wife at the time. And ironically, again, it was strangely prophetic, a lot of this stuff. But, you know, there's references to relationships in here. And then, you know, lo and behold, when this album, I mean, literally within a week or two after finishing the whole thing and having the finished product in my hand, bam, she just left me. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. You know, I'm surprised, and I think it's so cool that, you know, you were around in, like, the mid-60s, the rock scene then, and, you know, when stuff kind of got prog or whatever in the 70s. My question is, were you involved in the new wave and punk rock scene? Because this record seems to fit, like, right into that scene, you know?
Another really good question. My personal tendency is not to really be part of any scene or any group. I tend to be a bit on my own. Going back to probably, 1964, I got to say, probably one of the first things that really excited me in this world was the Beatles. And, I was born in England, and I knew about the Beatles before anybody in North America knew about them, because I used to get magazines from England when I was a kid. And I heard their music, and I just thought it was really cool. And so they were a bit of an inspiration. I thought, that's a good career path. So I had really, and as a child in England, my parents had me take classical piano. I mean, I did the Royal Conservatory thing in London, a little kid, wanted to kind of, it appealed to me, making the music business. So right from the get-go with the Royal Family, that my concept was, I want to make it. And, you know, we had a couple of singles out, but we never really made it. Then with Troika, we got an album out with Atlantic, and we were touring. And again, that kind of got just shut down abruptly because the guitar player quit. We were a three-piece band, very unique, wanted to make it. That didn't happen. So I regrouped. So I always wanted to make it. So to answer your question, here we get to 1980, and the scene is a little different. And there were, if I remember correctly, it was a time when a lot of people seemed to be releasing self-made independent albums. And I thought, you know, I've always liked that, you know, kind of the mom and pop, small time, just, you know, really simple, not the big corporate thing, you know, just do a good thing, get it out simply. And I'll just put an aside in here. Another inspiration at that time for recording was I had read something about the first album recorded by the Police, and they had recorded it, I think, for somewhere, you know, $4,500, $5,000. And I thought, that's the way to do it. Not all this big, you know, spending tons of money on studio time. Get the stuff recorded, just go in and bang it out. And that's what we did with this album. I think the actual recording time was, I probably brought it in for, you know, around $5,000. And, you know, there was more expenses in terms of the artwork and all that and the pressing of the records. But, you know, I just really wanted to do it inexpensively, but not have it sound cheap. I wanted it really to sound good, which means that the songs had to be good, the band had to be well rehearsed. So I, at that time, with all these independent releases, I just thought, this is, you know, and I had these songs, it just seemed like the right time to go and do it. And I didn't really consider myself new wave or punk or anything. I don't care for labels particularly, but I was aware of what was going on out there, but I wanted to be a little different. And I also kind of just liked you know, I like the idea of rock, and it just kind of had this concept of a simple band that sounded on stage the way they sound on the record. And again, I don't know if that answers your question. I really wasn't part of a scene. I know that our drummer was much more into the scene, you know, in Vancouver. I mean, there were quite a lot of bands at that time, and you know, I used to listen to a lot of records. I had a huge record collection at the time. So I was plugged in, but I wanted to sound different. And I really thought about this album a lot. I mean, I didn't sit down and contrive it, but I had a really definite concept of how I wanted to, what I wanted to write about, how I wanted it to sound. And, you know, of course, there was always, like I said, the question when we went in the studio, what are we going to get recorded? Because I didn't know. I mean, I have practice tapes from probably a couple of weeks before we went into the studio that sound pretty rough, but it all came together. And, you know, I was a bit of a taskmaster. You know, I kind of laid down the law with the band. I said, you know, no beer or anything like that in the studio. We're going in there. It's coffee and mineral water. That's it. It's all business, and we're just going to bang this out. So that's what we did.
You know, you talked about – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, no. I kind of just, you know, I kind of get off on a bit of a tangent there, and I don't even know if I answered your question.
Well, you did. You talked about how you had a concept, and I think the concept of the album really does come through. You know, these lyrics are really unique. The whole vibe of the record is very unique. Do you think that might be because one of the reasons you had trouble getting this record signed or whatever? Because, it is unique. Like, the lyrics are very edgy lyrics, particularly for the time, particularly when contrasted against the music, you know?
Right. Well, you know, I think you hit it right on the head there, because I've actually been, since we got in touch and we're emailing, I've been going back in time and, you know, thinking about a lot of things I hadn't thought of for years. And I let me give you an example. There was a review. I took this album down to the newspaper in Vancouver for their music review. And I can't even remember the reviewer's name. It was a woman. And all I remember that she wrote was, she's completely concerned with sex and kind of dismissed the album. And I thought, oh, wow. You know, and then I kind of, in certain circles, I got criticized. And I would, I want to be careful here, but I'd call it that point in time, there was a certain feminism that was pretty critical of me. I remember meeting in New York, for instance, a friend of my brother-in-law's, or it might have been a family member, a woman who worked for a record company there. So I met her. She had, you know, I'd given her the album, and I met her somewhere down in the village for coffee. And I remember sitting across the table from her. I was already, like, you know, pretty devastated from all this pending divorce. She just sat there and looked right at me and told me she hated the album. And I'm like, well, you know, what can you say? Let's just have our coffee and nice to meet you and see you. But then I had other people, you know, fellow at Island Records, even the guy up at Atlantic, the other company, I can't remember. I know they were on Central Park South. I can't remember the name of the company, but they must have had somebody on them that I liked. They also said they genuinely liked it, but no one would sign me. And even the CBS guy out in Vancouver said, "This is," I remember him saying, "this is a hot little album you got here." But it was just weird. It was like this invisible shield. Like nobody had actually signed me. And I wasn't asking for a whole lot of money. I just wanted to basically get the thing out there. And then, you know, it's a very simple concept. Have a good product. Get this, the album out there. I didn't plan on distributing it myself. I mean, Hit Records is me. I came up with the idea of the name. It's, I basically own this whole album. It's my concept. And it just, and the same thing when I got to LA a couple, you know, a few years later, no one would just make a commitment. And I think there, in retrospect, there weren't lyrics like that around then. I don't think nowadays it would be a big deal. Things have changed. I wanted to push the envelope a bit, and I wanted to be true to myself, and I was really true to myself at that time. This is a really, really genuine album, you know? I mean, I really feel proud of it. Listening to it, I go, wow, this is a great album, and I really hadn't thought about it a lot, and I was really, really touched when, you know, I got your email saying how much you liked this album. I thought, this is really great. This kind of makes my life that somebody out there that doesn't know me and is really into music gets this album. I mean, I just love that. I just love that. And it really means a lot to me. So thank you very much.
Well, you're quite welcome, but it really is my pleasure. Michael, wrapping up this interview, you talked about, I think you said how when you write now, you write from a very genuine place. What did you do since The Flames, and are you doing anything right now musically?
Well, The Flames was 1980. What happened when, you know, basically my wife and the whole band just left me, I kind of made a bit of a promise to myself, well, that's the last time I'm going to get involved in a band situation. I'm not going to have my music based on other people's wanting to be with me or not, you know. So I went to L.A., and I met Joey Alkus, who he was one of the co-writers under a different name, Joey Levine, for, you know, Yummy Yummy. He also was a co-writer on Million Miles Away by the Plimsolls, and he and I were best friends in L.A. And we wrote quite a bit together, and again, we tried to play some songs, movies, this and that, and the next thing, and again, nothing really ever happened. It just seems to be, when I look at it from an objective point of view, I put out all the energy, but nothing, you know, happened in terms of it getting out there. So since The Flames, I've been writing constantly, and I got to the point, I don't know where it was, probably let's fast forward. I left L.A. in 1994, and I'm out in New Mexico now, and I've been in New Mexico since 1994. And there was a long period of time where I was on my own. Again, that's my story with various women in my life. But anyway, I was going through a period of my own, and I just, music became my friend. I would just write. It was what I did. It was, I just like writing songs. And I still write and record all the time. But what I do is I thought, you know what, I don't need a band. And I remember a long time ago, an A&R guy telling me something, or I don't know, I picked it up somewhere, that a song should be, you should just be able to play your song on a guitar, and it's viable. You don't need production or a band. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to be self-contained myself. So I write songs and I record them with acoustic guitar, voice and acoustic guitar. And the, again, a bit of an irony is I used to not like acoustic guitars because I thought it was all this folky kind of stuff, but it's simple. It's really simple. And so what I find is that writing and then performing it just with the acoustic guitar and voice is the most direct way from my soul to the listener's ear, and because there's not anything in between. you know, electronics, all this other stuff, except the recording process. So, yeah, all these years I've just written for the love of it. And it turned out, you know, somewhere along the line, I call it an obsession to make it in the music business kind of left me. And it came down to just the love of writing songs and recording them. I just really like doing that. And I haven't really put out any energy to go and try and make it in the business. In fact, I kind of think the music business is a bit of a difficult proposition in a lot of ways. It's not to say I wouldn't do it if the right opportunities arose, but I'm not, you know, hankering after it. And I just love writing songs and recording them. There's a great feeling of accomplishment and satisfaction from doing it. And so that's where I'm at. I've probably written, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs since the Flames and recorded them. So that's kind of what I've been doing.
Well, Michael, that's fantastic. I think that's the mark of a true artist. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Michael, you got to let us play a couple of these tracks on the Punk News Podcast. What tracks can What tracks can we play on the Punk News Podcast? What should we play?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because I love every one of the songs, but, you know, I could defer to you to make it, you know, just to, you choose what you like. I think if I had to play one song, I don't know, just it kind of does something for me. Is Somebody Call Me? It just rocks.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's play Somebody Call Me, and then maybe somewhere else in the podcast we'll play a couple of extra tracks. So this is Somebody Call Me by The Flames off an album that you can't find anywhere because it was never released, much to my great chagrin, because it's a great album. This is Somebody Call Me by The Flames. And, Michael, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Oh, you're very, very, very welcome. I really enjoyed this, and thank you very much.
Won't somebody call me? All alone, please somebody call me, I'm so alone. Won't somebody get on the telephone line, I wanna pick up the phone. Every good time somebody call me right now. If anybody needs me, please let me know. If anybody wants me, please call me now. Won't somebody get on the telephone line? I wanna pick up that phone every time somebody call me, right now.
We are back, and that was my interview with Michael Richards of the Flames. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
All right, so I think we're done. This has probably been a long show.
Mm.
So, yeah, we're cool. Well, we're good. So, Tom?
There's lots of bomb stuff to talk about, man. It couldn't have been done in a short, encapsulated period.
There's an incredible depth to their catalog, so.
Exactly. It's been fun, guys.
I've been ragging on Bomp a lot. I feel like I have a whole bunch of Bomp CDs around here. I don't want to get, like, beyond the ire of them. They've lasted forever. They'll outlast us.
Actually, you know, this is cool. Bomp just put out a new compilation last week. You guys see this? This is cool.
No.
Yeah.
I'll go back to it. Let's see.
Punk News Podcast Live.
Oh.
episode 194.
Someday they'll come across these in the landfills of future society and say, boy, they were a bunch of primitive twerps, huh?
Oh, boy. All right. Anyways, we should end this show. People aren't listening at this point anyways. I'm Adam. That's John. That's Tom. Email us at podcast@punknews.org if you want anything. But we don't have anything to give you. See you next week.